This is Line One, your health connection, a weekly program produced at the studios of KSKA. Each week, KSKA's host, Dr. Thad Woodard, puts you in touch with local and national experts in a variety of health and family issues. Opinions expressed are those of the host, guest, and callers, and do not represent those of KSKA, the licensee, or the underwriters. Here's your host, Dr. Thad Woodard.
Good afternoon. Welcome once again to Line One, your health connection. Before we get into today's program, I thought I'd comment some more on science and reasoning and why we should always try to keep an open mind and maybe not too desperately hang on to everything we believe, and should look at some of the evidence that is being promulgated that may make us want to change our ideas. One thing about a good scientific theory that you may not have thought about is it predicts the future. Very little things, few things do, but a good theory will predict things that can be brought out with an experiment in the future, and that's what makes good theories important. For example, evolution predicts that there's going to be transitional specimens found at the right age of strata that show organisms moving from one earlier kind of form to a later form, and that's been borne out. And all the great scientists and all the great theories fit that pattern. Why am I bringing this up? Well, we're beginning to see some leakage of our ability to get Americans and families to immunize their children. And there's a big concern among healthcare officials and experts in infectious disease that we're dropping our rate of immunization, and that will lead to more problems. People who are deciding not to immunize their kids are using various arguments, but one in particular is that their children are not at risk for these vaccine-preventable diseases. A recent study has looked at this later belief, and it's reported in Pediatrics, where the researchers at Kaiser Permanente in Colorado looked at 156 confirmed cases of whooping cough. They compared those cases with 600 controls that were matched, and what they found is that in the children who had whooping cough, at least 12% of the families had refused at least one dose of the vaccination, whereas in the control group, only a half of a percent. What that figures out to is that there was a 23-fold higher risk of pertussis in those individuals who had refused at least one dose of the whooping cough vaccine. The authors conclude, quote, a greatly increased risk for pertussis infection occurs among children refusing whose parents refused this vaccine, and dispels the commonly held belief among vaccine refusers that children are not at risk for vaccine-preventable diseases. Along the same track, there is evidence that we're seeing a slight resurgence in the number of cases of whooping cough and measles, mumps, and rubella. And in the last year or two, for the first time, some cases of meningitis due to some of the vaccine-preventable illnesses have also been reported. Today we're going to be talking about sleep, however. My guest is Dr. David Klayman. He's joining us from San Francisco, where he's the director of the University of California San Francisco Sleep Disorders Clinic. He did most of his medical training at Southwestern Medical School in Texas, where he had fellowships in pulmonary medicine and critical care, but did his sleep studies later at Stanford University. Dr. Klayman, welcome to Line One.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Should we tell him how we got to know each other? I was introduced to Dr. Klayman from his brother. Who's your brother?
My brother is the acting mayor of Alaska, Matt Klayman.
Matt was nice enough to contact me and suggest that we get his brother David on, which I think is a very nice thing to do, and I'm glad that Matt was listening to the program at times.
So we both try to do public service.
Well, it's a great pleasure to get to talk with you. So I want to get into some issues about sleep that I think affect all of us in one way or another, but I always like to get into some of the basics of sleep to start with. So let's define sleep, and what is it that's different about sleeping, perhaps as far as what the brain does, that helps us characterize what sleep really is?
Well, sleep is, I think, an endlessly fascinating state. For a long, long time, it was felt to be a totally passive state where nothing active happened. But recent research, because the field of sleep medicine has only been 40 to 50 years old, it really has shown that sleep is a very highly regulated physiologic state. The brain is not interactive with the environment as a normal rule. You kind of, you know, you basically are unresponsive to the environment most of the time, unless the stimulus is sufficient enough to wake you up. But it's reversible. You go to sleep and you reverse that and wake up when you're finished sleeping. There are various definitions by EEG, you know, the brainwave pattern that we can also define. But there's various ways of looking at it.
There has to be some way or sensitivity of the person who's sleeping to be aroused from a, if we look at it purely from an evolutionary standpoint, you don't want to be sleeping in a tree with lots of potential animals around that might like to have you for dinner if you're not going to be aroused at times. So there's a disadvantage really to get into too much sleep, I would think.
Well, that's true, I guess, but most of us as adults, even in the deeper stages of sleep, can be woken up if necessary. But there's, you know, some people are deeper than others. Kids in particular, you know, they are deep sleepers much of the night, and that's why they need a protective home environment so that they can get their rest and not, you know, need to respond. The evolutionary side of it, you're right, that was always an issue.
So why is it that we now think that almost all animals, I guess, need a period of sleep? What is the function of sleep?
Well, to date, it's still unknown. So that's part of why sleep is endlessly fascinating, to be truthful. Obviously, on a functional basis, if you're up all night, you're going to know because of how rotten you feel the next day that you wished you'd slept. So, you know if you're sleep-deprived that you're going to feel a lot worse. There are physiologic changes that happen with the brain and the body, and at some level, dreaming sleep, where our mind is very active but the body is paralyzed, also must have some restorative function, but we just don't know exactly what that function is.
Okay. I've heard that it has a lot to do with just reformulating and categorizing and storing the daily memories that are going on, and that certainly phases of memory are very, very important for sleep. Is that part of it, we think, now?
Yes, the research would show that dream sleep is somehow important in memory consolidation. But what the exact biochemical relationship is, we still don't know.
Kiddo. Let me remind our listeners, you're listening to Line 1, your health connection. If you've got questions or comments about what you hear today, I'm going to give you a couple of ways you can get in touch with us between now and 3 o'clock local time, and we'll try to address your questions and our comments. Our local number, 550-8433. 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email me at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. And please remember, we're on until just before 3 o'clock today, and then we repeat from 8 to 9 each evening. And if you're listening at that time, there's no questions that can be brought up, entertained during that period of time between 8 and 9 tonight. Let's talk about some other aspects of sleep that we can get off the table, and then we'll move on to some issues related to abnormal sleep. But what is normal sleep duration? What's a normal sleep pattern? And I put normal in quotes in both of my questions.
Well, a normal sleep duration, to some degree, is a function of age, because newborns have, you know, longer and different sleep patterns than adults. Newborns start by going into dreaming sleep, and a lot of their sleep is dreaming sleep more than an average adult. But by the time you're, you know, late teens and around, 18 to 20 years of age, I would say that the average adult needs somewhere between 7.5 and 8.5 hours per night. And you know, there's a bell-shaped curve, so it varies from person to person. But if you're if you don't have to get up for work or school and you don't have to set an alarm, that would be the typical duration that you would need, 7.5 to 8.5 hours. A normal sleep pattern in an adult, you'd go into some of the non-dreaming stages of sleep for the first 1 to 2 hours, and then you'd have your first dreaming period. And a normal adult will have 4 to 6 dream episodes per night, and you won't necessarily remember all those dream episodes unless you wake up after them. But a normal person dreams multiple times per night. And the deepest stage of sleep is the first 1 or 2 hours in most people when we have what's called the slow wave sleep or delta sleep. You don't really need to know that for just observing your family members sleeping, but that's part of the analysis that we can do in a research facility or during a sleep study.
All right. We already have a phone call and an email, and before I get to that, I want to get one more bit of information out on the table. Let's talk about, you've mentioned it somewhat, that there's different phases of sleep and perhaps the characteristics of them. Many of us maybe have heard of REM and non-REM sleep. Would you just define some of these issues for us, and then we'll go to these questions?
Sure. REM sleep stands for rapid eye movement sleep, and that is, in colloquial terms, what dreaming sleep is. Normally, when you go into dreaming sleep, almost all the muscles in your body are paralyzed. The heart pumps, the breathing muscles breathe, and the eye movements move, but your body generally is paralyzed during dreaming sleep. And dreaming sleep is about 20 to 25% of normal sleep time in adults. The rest of sleep is non-dreaming sleep, or so-called non-REM sleep. And there's different sleep stages. To be technical for a moment, stage 1, which is the lightest sleep, is the easiest one to wake up from. If you've been asleep just for 1 or 2 minutes, sometimes your spouse can nudge you and say, "You're snoring, wake up and move over," and people won't even realize that they've that they've dozed off. Stages 2 and 3 of non-REM sleep are the more common stages. Stage 2 is the most common stage of sleep, and stage 3 is the delta sleep or slow-wave sleep that I mentioned earlier.
Okay. All right. I'm going to take one of the emails that we've gotten, and it says, the question is, please discuss the possible reasons why someone would wake up several times at night from 11 p.m. to 6:30 a.m., yet not be tired in the morning and not during the day, or if so, only rarely. The waking periods are exceedingly brief and just long enough to note that there seems to be a pattern of waking at 3 a.m. and maybe at 5 a.m. Dreaming does occur at least just before rising in this individual?
Well, it's a good question. When people wake up periodically at night, one of the things that I often think about is it a normal pattern or an abnormal pattern? And to some degree, I think this does depend on age. As we get older, it's more common that we'll wake up from time to time. And men in particular wake up to go to the bathroom 1 or 2 times a night, gets certainly common by the age of 50, 60, or 70. If you get back to sleep quickly, then and you don't have daytime symptoms of sleepiness, then it probably is just a normal part of your sleep pattern. If you wake up 3 times a night and you're awake for an hour each time, that's not the way this question was described, but if you were awake for an hour each time, that would be a form of insomnia. And then we'd try and figure out, was it a physical problem that woke the person up, like pain or breathing issues, or was it more stress and worrying that was keeping someone up? Because there are different causes of insomnia. It's worth mentioning in this sense that many people fondly remember back to being teenagers when they could sleep 10 hours straight and not wake up at all. But that doesn't last into adulthood. Most people will wake up 3 to 5 times per night, and if you're lucky, as in this question, it's a brief awakening and doesn't lead to daytime symptoms. So that would be my long-winded answer to this question.
So what I heard is that most of us do have short, brief periods of awakening, and that is not harmful and not a risk to health in any way, as long as it's not prolonged and affecting the how you feel, so to speak.
Correct.
Okie doke. Thanks very much. Got another caller on the line. Jeff, you're on line one. What can we do for you?
Hi. I have sleep apnea. It was discovered. Apparently, I had it long before it was discovered. I use a CPAP machine. I have sleeping problems because even with the humidifier on the CPAP, my nostrils eventually clog up, and I use a nasal mask. I tried a full face mask. Doesn't work. All of which is prologue to... Are there any effective sleeping aids like medication that do not adversely affect the in sleep stages? You know, just being unconscious is not really full sleep. And I'll take my response off the air.
Okie doke.
Well, there's several different questions, I guess. Sleep apnea is a common sleep disorder, and the CPAP treatment that he mentioned is a mask treatment with connected to an air compressor. And many times people do get their nose clogged from the extra airflow. If you don't have a heated humidifier, if you only have a room temperature humidifier, one step up on that could be to get a heated humidifier and see if that helps prevent the nasal congestion. And if it's allergy related, you could either try Benadryl, which would be a sedating antihistamine that might help keep the nose cleared up at bedtime, or a non-sedating antihistamine like Claritin or Zyrtec that are both over-the-counter. Benadryl, if you took that at night, might help keep the nose open and work as a sleeping pill. It's certainly the ingredient in Tylenol PM and has not been shown to affect sleep stages. So in that sense, it would be a reasonable and simple approach if it was effective. In terms of other medicines that don't change sleep stages, the old literature on benzodiazepines like Valium is that they can increase stage 2 sleep and potentially affect other sleep stages. But the newer class of hypnotic medications like Ambien and Lunesta, those are less likely to affect sleep stages and are felt to be safe to use in this circumstance.
Okie doke. I'm going to go ahead and take our one single short break. You're listening to Line 1, your health connection on KSKA. I'm Dr. Thad Woodard.
Stroke is an emergency. Providence, Alaska Medical Center is committed to increasing awareness of the symptoms of stroke if you or anyone you know has sudden weakness on one side of your body, sudden confusion, trouble speaking or understanding, sudden trouble seeing, walking, or loss of balance, or sudden severe headache without cause, call 911 and get to the hospital within 1 hour. Information at providence.org/Alaska. This message is sponsored by Providence, Alaska Medical Center.
Welcome back. This is Line 1. I'm your host, Dr. Thad Woodard, and today we're talking with Dr. David Klayman. He's director of the University of California, San Francisco Sleep Disorders Center. If you have questions or comments about what you hear today, let me give you a couple of ways to get in touch with us. Locally, you can dial 550-8433, 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752. And email at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, all one word, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. And we'll address your questions or comments about sleep disorders. Let's go ahead and take another caller. Tina, you're on line one.
Hi. I wanted to talk about weight gain and lack of sleep. It's something that I've always kind of thought was connected, and now recently I noticed there are some studies out that are pointing in that direction. And I was wondering if they know what stage of sleep is missing or how to help that from or prevent that from happening, because it's just exhausting. Well, in so many ways.
So your question is a imperfect sleep pattern or hygiene associated with increased weight gain? Is that
Yes, that is okay. My question.
Okay, Doc.
Well, it's a good question, because I think for many years, you know, commenting specifically about obesity and sleep apnea, the feeling had always been that it was all the obesity that was causing the problem, and the sleep apnea was sort of the end result. But there has been research describing the interruptions in sleep caused by sleep apnea that can affect metabolism and potentially impact on hormonal levels. It's been harder, to come back to your question, to say that a specific sleep stage is the cause of, you know, alterations in metabolism or in appetite or weight, but it does seem to be the interruptions. And I think in sort of simple terms, I've sometimes thought, well, if somebody is so tired from their sleep disorder that they're more likely to eat to stay awake, then that would be one mechanism. But there also appear to be some underlying metabolic changes that make your body less likely to use up the energy that you're eating, and so it can predispose you to weight gain.
Is there something that a person can do to counteract that? I mean, if there's been actual changes to the metabolism?
Well, generally, as far as I can tell from the research, the first thing would be to see your doctor and make sure that you had normal blood tests looking for thyroid disease and diabetes. So
yeah,
that,
I'm clear on those. So.
but still, you know, just for other listeners, I would say that seeing your doctor to discuss these things is rather important, because if there are other diseases that are causing the weight gain, you'd certainly want to address those specifically. As far as I know, the most helpful thing in terms of metabolism and using up, you know, the amount of calories that you're eating is just regular exercise. I don't think there's much research into any other areas. If you have coexisting sleep apnea, then the CPAP treatment might be the most helpful approach to that. Yeah. But hopefully that it hasn't gotten that bad in your situation.
Not to my knowledge, but I've never actually gone to a sleep clinic or anything to know if I'm having sleep apnea. But thank you. That's helpful. Exercise, of course, the answer to everything.
I wish I had a better one.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
I would wonder also, I mean, it seemed like this would be difficult. There's a lot of confounding variables. People who might be depressed or unhappy may have a tendency to sleep more or have more on disordered sleep, as well as having disorders of appetite.
That's true, and I think in Alaska, where you have such extremes of daylight hours, that you're much more active in the summer, and then you imitate a hibernating bear in the winter. There's quite a bit of extreme variation.
We have another email that I want to address. The question is there a relationship between very mild, and the person that says essentially asymptomatic asthma, and sleep patterns, such as waking up briefly during the night? Do other diseases or conditions also affect sleep patterns? And if so, do they impact one's health in the long term? That's kind of an open-ended question there.
Sure, but it's a good one, because I think that if you wake up at night, or if you have a symptom that wakes you up, say, you know, asthma and being short of breath, waking up at night is a very non-specific symptom, which means that, you know, many physical issues can wake people up, whether it's a breathing problem from heart or lung disease, or chronic pain if you have arthritis or hip issues. And people who have depression and anxiety disorders can certainly wake up frequently at night. Coming back to the first question that was emailed in, if you just wake up occasionally and get back to sleep, then it's not really going to be a major problem for your health. But say you wake up from asthma 3 or 4 times a week, and you can feel the wheezing and use your inhaler, then we would say that's evidence that your asthma is not well controlled. And in that instance, we'd say, well, we need to be more aggressive about your asthma treatment. the way this email question was formed, asymptomatic and not needing much treatment, it may not be something that's abnormal or needs intervention, but if you were not on a long-acting bronchodilator treatment, then you could talk to your doctor and try a long-acting medication, and if suddenly you were sleeping through the night, then you'd say, well, maybe it was the asthma causing more trouble than I realized.
So they really want to be sure that perhaps from a partner or not, that they're not waking up because of cough or something they may not be aware of that's related to their asthma.
Exactly.
You know?
And now we have those long-acting bronchodilators like Advair and Spiriva that get, and that can keep people going through the night without needing to wake up to take extra doses. So there are more options to see if it's going to be beneficial.
The other question in this was the effect on one's health if they're being wakened a number of times. And I think I'm going to come back to that. That's another whole issue is what about poor sleep and health in general? And we've got a couple other callers, and I'll try to make sure we address that question specifically as well. So next I'll take Linda. You're on line one. What can we do for you?
Well, good morning or afternoon. I have a question about my son who is 20 and in college, and he insists that he has a sleep disorder. I can't even remember what he calls it, but of course he's looked it up, where he's up all night and sleeps during the day. And, you know, he manages to get up when he has to, if he has to go to class or has to go snowboarding or something like that. But in general, his preference, and he doesn't feel very good, he says, until about 5 or 6 in the afternoon. And then he's up all night. And it truly worries me because the world is kind of the other way around, as you know.
What was he like that before he went to college?
You know, he started getting that way as a teenager,
okay.
And I think that's somewhat normal from what I hear. Lots of times that happens with teenagers. But, I mean, it's gotten more and more pronounced, and I always thought, well, as a teenager, if you stay up until 2, maybe okay. But, I mean, he stays up all night.
Okay.
And he's a musician. He likes to play music and fiddle around with the computer. And, I mean, it's not that he's unhappy doing this, but I worry about it just in terms of jobs and, you know, all of that. And I have to add that he's also an honor student. Hello. So
okay.
A little bit, I can't get too upset about him, but that bothers me.
Okay, good question.
And was he like this in elementary school and middle school, or did it only come on in high school?
Came on in high school.
Okay.
Did not
and
come
if he and if he and if he's up at night and sleeps in the daytime, his schedule for doing that stays pretty consistent. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, his preference would be to do that all the time. But sometimes, of course, you know, there are things like classes. Although he's managed to get most of his classes in the evening, there's an occasional one during the day that he has to go to. But
right. Yeah,
that's his preference, really, is to be up at night and sleep during the day. Even though I think there's a part of him that feels bad about it, would like to be, you know, outside in the sunshine sometimes. I mean, he's sort of turned into kind of this vampire kid up only at night. So
let me make his
being slightly depressed a lot, too, because he's alone a lot. He's up at night by himself, you know.
Let me try and answer a few points, and Dr. Woodward, if I get too long-winded, then please stop me. But what you're describing is a form of a circadian rhythm disorder, which is a fairly, you know, important area to talk about in terms of sleep disorders. Now, there are people who have a totally irregular sleeping schedule. But then if people have an irregular sleeping schedule, what often happens is they'll keep changing their sleep hours all the time. And the way you're describing your son, it sounds like one of the two more common sleep disorders, and the most common one is delayed sleep phase. I'm sure that's the term he found on the internet. The other one is advanced sleep phase. So delayed sleep phase is very common in teenagers. It's estimated to potentially affect as many as 10 to 15% of teenagers. And the description of delayed sleep phase is, I like to stay up late and I like to sleep in the morning. And the opposite of it is the advanced sleep phase, where you tend to get tired by the early evening, and it's more common in the elderly. I like to go to bed early, and I like to wake up early is the more common description for advanced sleep phase. And the challenge of the delayed sleep phase is that if you keep getting a later and later sleep schedule, it gets very hard to wake up and get the day started. And in fact, that's the more common intervention for delayed sleep phase, is to say, well, if you really want to change your schedule, what you have to do actually is change the wake-up time and start to get up. Usually, if somebody's waking, if they, say for your son, if he goes to bed at 5 or 6 a.m. and gets up at 12 or 1, what you try and do over the course of a week or two is have him move his bedtime up 30 to 60 minutes every day or two, and slowly move back to an earlier time of waking up. The standard treatments for delayed sleep phase are bright light in the morning when you get up. So I usually tell people, you know, get up and immediately go outside and have your breakfast out in the sunlight. And if he's getting up at 10 or 11, he certainly would have sunlight available if it's a sunny day like I was told today is in Anchorage. The other treatment that's not really medically approved, but some people will do it, is to take melatonin pills at bedtime. And the melatonin is a very short-acting. It's available in health food stores and does appear to affect circadian rhythms, but it's not as healthy as the sunlight approach. Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay. But the term would be delayed sleep phase.
Okay, got it. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right, let's take another caller. Mike, you're on line one.
Hey, thanks. I just had a question about some alternative sleep cycles that kind of are outside of the 8-hour block. Things like sleeping 30 to 40 minutes every couple of hours. And have there been any like studies done on those?
It's a good question. I'm pausing a minute because I don't remember any offhand. There probably have been a few studies looking at short sleep duration, but in general, when you only sleep 30 minutes or so at a time, you're not able to go through the full sleep cycle that you need to feel rested. I remember, it's a common description for people, if they're woken up in the middle of the night, back when I was an intern and resident, I always found that if I went to sleep at 11 or 12 and I could sleep for 3 hours, and 3 hours is generally enough to get you through a whole cycle of sleeping through your first dreaming period, you actually feel somewhat rested by that cycle, and you can wake up, not easily, but you can wake up and function well. But if you go to sleep and you're woken up after 30 to 40 minutes, it feels like someone's hitting you on the head with a sledgehammer, and it's very hard to feel rested because you have not been able to get through a whole cycle. If, you know, from your question, if you were, say, working to some really, really urgent deadline and you just had to do that for a night or two, you certainly wouldn't get good rest because you aren't staying asleep for long enough to go through the cycles, but it might be enough to kind of help you compensate for a short period of time. But long term, it would not feel like restful sleep.
Gotcha. Okay. Well, thanks.
You're welcome.
So a person who might have to, for a period of time, for a month or so, maybe for because of a job where they got 3 or 4 hours of sleep and then had to do some work and then got another 3 or 4 hours of sleep, as long as they were getting that kind of length of time to their sleep, they would perhaps do fine and wouldn't have any of the unusual consequences, or at least at this point in our understanding of sleep, wouldn't have any consequences. Is that what I'm hearing you say?
Probably I would amend it a tiny bit and say that if you did that, if you, you know, worked, if you slept 3 hours at a time, you know, twice a night or 4 hours at a time, you wouldn't feel as good as you would getting 8 hours. but it would be better than, you know, not sleeping, or better than, you know, doing an hour at a time more frequently.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the studies on sleep deprivation, interestingly, have been sponsored by the Department of Defense to see how long can soldiers be awake and still be alert and functional.
Right.
And it seems that, to some degree, the cutoff for sleep deprivation, the cutoff for more significant sleep deprivation, is around 6 hours. If you're sleeping more than 6 hours, you'll feel tired, but not necessarily really symptomatic of being sleepy in the day. But if you sleep less than 6 hours a night, it really magnifies the symptoms of sleep deprivation.
And this gets to a question that was just it seemed like I read something recently that relates to this somehow. What was sleep like? What do we know about how people slept before there was electricity, before there were lights? I mean, what we used to be is the sun would go down, and if we didn't have fire or light, we couldn't see. And so what happened then, and what has changed since then? That do we know anything about that? Is it an important kind of change?
I guess my answer to that question, because it's a good question, is to quote one of the founding fathers of sleep medicine, William DeMent, who was at Stanford. And there have been some research trying to look at this question, and basically what has been done in this research is to try and estimate the amount of hours of sleep before and after the advent of electricity. So you have to go back, you have to go back to the 1800s to get communities that didn't have electricity. And it appears that communities on average, if you look at, you know, a bunch of different people back then, were probably sleeping on the range of 8.5 to 9 hours per night. And then the studies more recently looking at that from 20 or 30 years ago estimated that people were sleeping 7.5 to 8 hours per night. So that, you know, in roughly 100 years or so, society was suddenly sleeping about an hour less per night on average. That was what he estimated from the research that he did at that time. And so it's unlikely that we've evolved that much during such a short time period. But I think it speaks to the fact that, you know, you see coffee shops on street corners everywhere because people probably are more sleep deprived than they realize. And this is a way of compensating.
You're listening to Line One. My guest today is Dr. David Klayman. He is the director of the University of California at San Francisco Sleep Disorders Center, and we're talking about sleep and sleep disorders. If you've got questions or comments about this subject, you can reach us at 550-8433, locally 550-8433. We have a toll-free number, 1-888-353-5752, and you can email between now and 3 o'clock at line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E, at kska.org. Dr. Klayman, another email is a person who has written in and says, I always sleep too much all of my life. When I don't get, let's say, about 10 hours of sleep a night, I get tired, particularly with just the normal 8 hours of sleep on a daily basis. I've had it checked out before a very long time ago. Nothing really came of it. I also dream a great deal. At least this person thinks they do. Any comments or suggestions?
Well, it's a good question. I think it gets to the idea of how much sleep does a person need. And as I mentioned before, although the average person may need 7.5 to 8.5 hours, there is a bell-shaped curve distribution that you'll see a handful of people who only need 6.5 or 7 hours of sleep per night, and a handful of people who really do need 9.5 or 10 hours per night. So that if you were evaluated for this before and there was no underlying sleep disorder that was affecting you, then it may be that you're in that end of the bell-shaped curve who needs more hours per night to really feel rested. So there may not be an easy answer, but, you know, that would certainly be a reasonable way to look at it.
Okey-doke. Dr. Klayman, my next caller is an individual named Matt Klayman. I don't know if you know him or not. Well, let's see what he has to ask us today.
Well, I have two questions. I'll get the questions out, and then I can take the answer off the air because I've heard him many times over the course of my life.
Hello there, Matt. Thanks for getting us connected.
Well, it's good to hear you on the radio, David. We just got to get you up here in person before too long.
That's right.
Two questions. One is, in the world of people who take afternoon naps, is there sort of a period of time that's a recommended or a typical time where you don't wake up too groggy and you can wake up from a nap and function pretty effectively? That's first question. And second question is, there's a lot of debate up here about school schedules and whether the high school kids should start later because of research suggesting their circadian rhythms mean they need to stay up later and sleep later in the morning to function effectively at school in the day. So if you were providing advice to the mayor or the superintendent of schools, would you suggest swapping the school bus schedules so high school started later than elementary school? Those are the questions, and I'll take the answer off the air.
Okay. Thanks for your questions.
Thanks for calling in. Well, those are two questions that are good food for thought. I'll come to the second political question first, although there is a physiologic basis for it. The first question was about afternoon naps. Was there a length that was optimal for a nap? And so it's actually a good question, and I'll digress a minute. Naps, in general, depend on what the circumstances are of why you need them. And I make that comment because if you're sleep deprived from work or jet lag or other things, then a nap is a very good thing. And there's certainly a normal physiologic basis for napping, which is why, you know, countries that believe in siestas have the siesta time. Because after lunch, you're often likely to feel tired enough that you could doze off. And the classic power nap is usually in the range of 20 to 30 minutes. You don't want it to be a lot longer for the average person. And a lot shorter doesn't tend to feel very restorative. So the typical power nap is 20 to 30 minutes. Now, the other set of circumstances where napping becomes a concern is if you have insomnia. If you fall asleep after dinner on the couch and sleep for an hour, you can predictably expect that you're going to have trouble falling to sleep that night. So that napping later in the afternoon or in the evening can often be a cause of insomnia. So if you have insomnia, we'll often say, well, napping is a bad idea, so be cautious about it. But for afternoon naps, I often would say to someone, if your schedule allows it, try 20 to 30 minutes in the early afternoon, right after lunch, if possible. And that would be a good length of time to try. And you might find that you needed a little shorter or a little longer nap, but that would be a typical answer. Does that make sense?
He was going to take that off the air.
Okay, hopefully. Okay. Now, the second question, I guess there's sort of the physiologic basis for the question and also a little bit about politics, which is, of course, not my forte, but still is an interesting issue. There are researchers, and Mary Karskadden is the most commonly quoted researcher. She's in Rhode Island and does a lot of work with adolescents and children. And she has always been a proponent of the idea that to optimize learning, you should be sensitive to the sleep rhythms of the students. And it is true that many high school students are incredibly tired in the morning at their first class. And it actually goes back to some degree to the question that was asked earlier by the mom about her honors college student. And that is that if you have the delayed sleep phase tendency, you sleep late on the weekends. If you sleep late until 10 or 11 on Saturday and Sunday, then, of course, you don't fall asleep until 1 or 2 o'clock on Sunday night. And getting up for class on Monday morning is very difficult. And so the morning classes are a real challenge. This isn't true for all high school students, but certainly a percentage of high school students have a lot more trouble than the younger kids. And so Mary Karskadden and others have recommended that high school shouldn't start before 9 o'clock because of this tendency. And so, you know, you could make this argument. The opposite side of it has to do with parenting schedules and the politics of changing when daycare would start or end. So it's a very complicated question, but I think if the only criteria that you were worried about was, you know, what was best for high school students, you could argue for the later start time, which would accommodate those kids that tend to be more sensitive to these issues.
From a another way of looking at this, that's what I've kind of heard, and we've talked about this on the program before, that would make sense, but it's much more expensive, and it gets to the issue is even all students need to be taught in slightly different ways, and can you really afford that as a culture to meet those needs? So it does get into some political and, as usual, economic issues as well, even though we may know the correct answer for the majority of kids about the sleep issue from a physiologic standpoint.
Right, and, you know, Dr. Woodard, you're probably used to dealing with adolescents who have delayed sleep phase types of symptoms in your pediatric practice. And the challenge with that group is that although what they love to do is sleep late on Saturday and Sundays, sleeping late on Sundays in particular is often what tends to get the problem to persist.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not a fun or easy thing, but, you know, if it's a motivated student who wants to try and change something that would help them to function better at school, getting up on Sunday morning closer to the usual school hour may not be appealing, but it is an effective approach.
Yep. You've got to kind of back into a normal sleep schedule as well
That's
as you
right.
can. All right, here's an email from a gentleman who says, I've been using sleep aids for years, such as Tylenol PM. I'd love to get off of them. Do you have any advice?
Well, that's a great question, because Tylenol PM is Benadryl. It's certainly the most commonly used sleep aid in the United States, and there's no data on how much it's used. You can get data on some of the prescription medications. But it comes back to the question of insomnia. Insomnia is one of the more common sleep disorders. It's estimated that about 10% of the population in the U.S. has chronic insomnia, and up to 25 or 30% has occasional insomnia. So it's a very common symptom, and it can either be, you know, not getting to sleep at the start or not staying asleep, or even waking up early and being unable to return to sleep. So there's different symptoms. But really, the best treatment to try to focus on for insomnia are behavioral changes. The term that you can look up on the internet for behavioral treatment of insomnia is called sleep hygiene, just like you spell good personal hygiene, but the term we use is sleep hygiene, or cognitive behavioral therapy. So CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy, is a set of good sleeping practices to incorporate into your schedule. And there are books and websites that talk about this. So that's certainly the direction I would go. Normally what I tell people in a nutshell is to make sure that you're exercising if you can, that you don't nap at all if you have insomnia, that you don't have caffeinated drinks after lunchtime to make sure that you don't stay awake and stay wound up from the caffeine, and find something at bedtime that helps you stay relaxed so that you're drowsy, and work on those cognitive behavioral changes for 1 to 2 weeks, and then start trying to go to sleep without taking the Tylenol PM. Especially on weekends, don't take the Tylenol PM if the weekends are the days that you don't work. And then see if you can improve things from there. Certainly it's something that you could be seen at a sleep specialty clinic if you couldn't make progress on your own.
All right. I would like to let our listeners know they must have been up late last night thinking about questions, because we've got a ton of them. We're not going to get to all of them. We'll do our best. We've got about 10 minutes. Let's do
one. I'll try
one.
To give shorter answers.
No, you're doing fine. This one, we haven't talked about children, so we've got a question. I have a daughter who has night frights since she was an infant. She's now 9 years of age. I had expected she would grow out of it by now, but she remains fearful of going to sleep because she'll wake up with unexplained, terrifying, and sometimes says that she's dying. Please address night frights in children.
Sure. Well, again, this is a good and interesting question, and I guess I would try to clarify the issues a little bit. I don't use the term night frights. What we talk about in sleep medicine is the difference between nightmares, and a nightmare is a bad dream, and it actually happens from dreaming sleep, versus a night terror, and a night terror is an episode that happens out of non-dreaming sleep. And at least for what you're describing in the question, the most common cause of this in a nine-year-old would actually be the night terror. Usually it happens in the first 1 to 2 hours after daughter goes to sleep. And so your daughter will wake up screaming loudly, but not realize who she is or where she is. They're usually confused for a little while, and in the morning won't remember the episode. So if it's a night terror, the most common thing that leads to it actually is sleep deprivation. It's paradoxical, but oftentimes if you get your daughter to bed 30 to 60 minutes earlier, that will eliminate a lot of the episodes, and I've had good success with that in a number of families. If it's a nightmare and it honestly is dreaming sleep, then it's something that you'd have to work with your pediatrician about. I have less experience seeing kids come in for nightmares, and a lot of the time then you just have to be reassuring to them and try and work through what their anxieties are in the daytime and in the nighttime if it really appears to be bad dreams or nightmares. Hopefully that makes sense.
Another writer had mentioned that she has quite a bit of night. She walks in her sleep quite a bit. She'd heard that may be related to some mental health problems and wonders if that's true.
Say the question again.
Does someone who has difficulty with walking in their sleep necessarily have a mental health problem?
Sorry. Well, sleepwalking, in fact, is very related to night terrors. They both happen out of non-dreaming sleep. There are probably a subset of people who have night terrors or sleepwalking where it is related to psychological anxieties or post-traumatic stress. But to be honest, for the majority of people, it's very hard for us to find any risk factors. And both night terrors and sleepwalking can run in families. So if it's something that, you know, the parents did, it may be related in that fashion. The main issue with sleepwalking, similar to night terrors, is don't stay up too late. Make sure that oftentimes going to bed earlier will actually reduce the number of episodes. And you do want to kind of safeguard the room so that you're not likely to crash into furniture or glass tables and end up with injuries.
So that many people with these active things that happen in the middle of the sleep, what I hear you saying is you need to try to do everything you can to get a good night's sleep and be well rested, and then those kind of issues are less likely to happen.
Well, that's a much more appealing alternative in terms of treatment, because if somebody has a lot of sleepwalking and they've injured themselves periodically, then you have to debate whether they need some type of a sleeping pill to prevent the sleepwalking. And that's inherently a less appealing treatment approach unless these other interventions are not helpful.
Okay. We have a caller. Diane, you're on line one.
Oh, hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have been dealing with insomnia for about 10 years, and I've tried all of the sleep hygiene methods. I've read books, been to the sleep disorder clinic. And my problem is that I awaken in the, 3 to 4 hours after I fall asleep. I have no trouble falling asleep, but always wake up, 2 or 3 a.m. and cannot get back to sleep and suffer a lot from sleep deprivation. And I'm just wondering, aside from the basic sleep hygiene methods, are there any other, it sounds like you may have answered my question earlier, there really aren't a lot of other alternatives to help solve insomnia?
It depends on the circumstances, and you're kind of nice in your description that it's a specific situation. So the first treatment for insomnia, as you outlined, are going to be behavioral interventions, the sleep hygiene changes, and making sure when you wake up that you're not frustrated or worried about it. So I assume that you've already tackled that angle.
Well, you know, it's funny. I've been to the Sleep Disorder Center three different times, spaced apart, because I've been trying to deal with it on my own as well. The first doctor, funny enough, told me I should just stay up all night, and sooner or later I'll get so tired I'll go to sleep. That didn't work. I was falling asleep driving. That didn't work. I went back later, and one of the docs helped me with some insight into how I was approaching all the anxiety that you experience when you wake up at night. So I've tried to relax about that, and that did help a little bit. And then now I'm taking Rosarum and melatonin and going to sleep like at midnight, but I still wake up at 4 a.m. and I'm, you know, just dealing with sleep deprivation. And I've tried so many things. I don't know if I'm missing something or if I should just persist. And
well, no, you're working on the right approaches. Let me say that Rosarum and melatonin, Rosarum is a melatonin receptor agonist. Those are both short-acting, and although they're worth trying, I will say that they're not typically that helpful for problems of early morning awakenings, the way you're describing it. Usually, the two things I've tried, you know, in your situation, aside from longer-acting sleeping pills, which are an option, but one option is bright light in the evening. In Anchorage, you've got loads of that. Sometimes bright light in the evening for 30 to 60 minutes between 8 and 9 in the evening will delay your wake-up schedule, and that can help. And then the other approach, which is different than a sleeping pill, is actually try a non-sedating antidepressant, something like Paxil or Lexapro or Celexa. You'd want to talk with either your internist or your sleep specialist
about that. I've heard trazodone.
Idea.
Trazodone mentioned a couple of times, and I didn't know.
No, not trazodone, because trazodone is sedating. I would try a non-sedating antidepressant that helps reduce anxiety, and you'd use a low dosage. You could take it in the morning or the evening. I've had success with that in some patients, so it's not a guarantee, but it's a different treatment approach.
Okay.
Try the bright light first.
The bright light, yeah. It seems like such a simple problem, and I've tried so many thoughtful ways to solve it, and it's very perplexing.
Right.
For sure. So
right.
I appreciate it. I'll look at that. Oh, one more question. The next bridge I was going to go across with this is a naturopath doctor advised that I should try neurotransmitter testing to see if I'm low on my neurotransmitters. Do you know anything about that?
I'm skeptical.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. I'd never heard it mentioned from any of my MDs, and this is something very, you know, out of the norm that I've ever read or heard about. Okay.
Yep.
Good luck.
Thank you, Diane.
Thank you.
Well, we're at the end of our time, Dr. Klayman. I very much appreciate your taking the time to be with us today.
We had great questions. Thank you,
yeah,
everyone,
we have
for
some
calling in, and thank you for hosting me.
We have even more questions, but we won't be able to get to them, so I apologize. Have a good afternoon. We'll be back next week, and we're going to be talking about potential health problems of exercise in cold air, especially with elite athletes like cross-country skiers, with Dr. Michael Keeley. So tune into your health and learn more next Monday, June 8th at 2 p.m. For Line 1, this is Dr. Thad Woodard. Have a great day.
This has been Line 1, your health connection. If you have questions or comments concerning this program, write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508, or email us at line1@ksKA.org. Additional information on today's show topic, including relevant website links, will be posted along with audio of today's program on our website at ksKA.org/line1. CD copies of this program can be purchased by calling 550-8400 during regular business hours. This is KSKA, Anchorage.